Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
Broadcasting from the Hip Hop Weekly Studios, I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja, and he speaks so eloquently. Don't you agree? Do you hear the velvet in it? Okay, I'm sorry. Sometimes I get a little carried away, but his tone is just so... Anyway, he's Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward, and you are tuned in to Civic Cypher.
Yes, sir. We're going to have some fun today. Stick around because we got a lot to talk about per usual. We are going to be spending some time talking about a Brooklyn neighborhood that policed itself.
Is Brooklyn in the house?
Without a doubt.
Okay, that's listen, what I thought.
We talk a lot on this show about the Defund the Police movement. We've renamed it a couple of times, but effectually what we've described it as a reallocation of police resources and a rethinking of what policing means. And so now we have a little bit more data, and we're going to talk about it. Some has been positive, some has been challenging, but today we have a positive case, and we'd love to share the details of that with you. Also, just in time for Father's Day, we're going to be talking about Black fatherhood, specifically the myths surrounding absent Black fathers in this country, which...
A heck of a story to tell and then perpetuate, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, you may have grown up thinking, well, Black people just need to stay in the homes and raise their kids. Well, as it turns out, Black people are better at doing that than everybody else, Black men specifically. And the data supports that. In short, you can check that out via the CDC or just a quick Google search and you'll find out that Black fathers are doing better than everyone else. But we're going to talk about it, of course, in more detail on the show. And of course, many, many other things that you'd like to hear about, including the largest deportation in U.S. history, which affected our Mexican-American brothers and sisters. So stay tuned for that. But first and foremost, like we always do at this time, we're going to discuss some ebony excellence. How does that sound, Q?
Shall we?
We shall. So this is my favorite. Brought to you by Major Threads for the finest in menswear. Check out majorthreads.com. This comes from XXL Magazine. Tupac Shakur, I'll say it, the best rapper ever. Greatest rapper of all time.
You guys can't see me, but I definitely just threw up the West Side one time for the late, great Tupac Amaru Shakur.
Listen, and if you want to debate me, I'm ready. I'll stay ready for that one. But Tupac Shakur has finally been honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. On June 7th, he posthumously joined the increasing list of rappers turned actors who've been enshrined on the world famous Hollywood Walk of Fame. Seems like it would have already happened by now, but no.
I would have thought it was overdue, except I assumed it had already happened.
Yeah, same. Anyway, the ceremony was led by Los Angeles radio legend and our good friend Big Boy.
Big Boy.
And Tupac's sister accepted the award. On his behalf, it was the 2,758 star, and there were speeches from Jamal Joseph, and He was the one who directed Dear Mama, Saga of Afeni and Tupac Shakur. And let's see, his newly minted star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame is located.
Just a quick correction. Alan Hughes directed that.
Oh, okay.
Jamal Joseph is a writer and activist who was also present. And shout out to Mo Preem, Tupac's brother.
Perfect. Thank you for that. Yeah, I misread that. Okay. And if you want to check out the star, it's located at 6212 Hollywood Boulevard in Hollywood, California. And now he joins other hip hop notables such as DJ Khaled, Missy Elliott, and the late Nipsey Hussle. And of course, he's got lots of musical work, but film work as well. The star is well deserved. So shout out to Tupac. That is Ebony Excellence. If I ever seen it. So that made me very happy.
Indeed.
All right. So defunding the police. Man, a great idea that was challenged, which I'm not mad at. Great ideas need to be challenged, right? It was, I think we both Q and I here on the show, we both have had wished that it had been marketed better.
I just wish they'd had a think tank.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Spitballed some ideas on how should we phrase this, right? Because of course you can't explain everything in a catchphrase, but defund the police sounded so,
it's alarming.
It triggered an almost negative response even in people that supported the idea, like we've had Rams and I have had opportunities to have that conversation in long form, and at the end of that conversation looked at people who were like, oh yeah, that makes all the sense in the world. Even those people heard defund the police and were like,
right,
if we want to defund, we don't want to not have policing.
So, one of the things that I want to say, I feel like the people who may have come up with this idea, maybe they were being intentional about having something so alarming because for better or worse, it got everybody talking. Okay. For better or worse. That's true. But remember, at that time, we needed to have conversations. The police were killing people.
I think the focus group
would have
helped us not have such a negative immediate response. Even though it started conversations, in a lot of cases, both sides of the argument were coming to the table feeling the same. That's not what you want.
Yeah, that's not the type of conversation. But the fact of the matter is that having it take center stage meant that at least some people started to conceptualize what it means to rethink policing. Some people, I'll say it again, some people started to conceptualize what it means to rethink policing. So that's a baby step.
Operation Rethink Policing probably would have been a better phrase.
Sure. But maybe it might not have had the same gripping effect on the populace. Now, this is me maybe making excuses or maybe trying to, you know, imagine what the folks who came out with this idea might have been trying to do. I don't know. I don't want to profess to know. But the fact is that this idea rose up in late 2020 about defunding the police. And that led to a rethinking of what policing means, what policing should encompass. Remember, police were responding to things that didn't necessarily have anything to do with public safety.
Still.
Yeah. And they were responding to bona fide medical health related emergencies.
With weapons drawn.
You see what I'm saying? And you said this before on the show, to the man with the hammer, everything is a nail. Is there some sort of saying or anecdote or something like that, some sort of I forget the name of it, but I think it encompasses kind of the feeling when it comes to at least enough police to where we can identify there's a problem. Sure, not every police officer is bang bang shoot them up, let me get my gun first. I recognize and see that immediately, but there is a problem, and the people that turned a blind eye to this problem are the people often enough where the problem doesn't affect them or their communities.
It doesn't show up at their doorstep, so it's not happening,
right?
Or it's not important.
So let's say if, even if we just take a small number, 1% of the police is they're out of pocket, out of line, and 99% are good.
1% is a high number.
But listen, let's hear me out, because it's simple for the listeners to follow. 1% of the police are bad. They're pulling out guns or mistreating people, police brutality, not playing by the rules, doing illegal activity, you name it, right? If, because the consequences are so dire for police mistakes, and indeed, police end up making up for it, and taxpayers, because of qualified immunity, police are never held accountable for mistakes they make, or indeed, egregious overstepping of their boundaries. But let me say this. Because the consequences are so dire, because oftentimes they're life and death, because they're recorded, because we have to witness it, and because it doesn't affect certain communities, they're able to turn a blind eye to it. Now let's swap it out. Let's say 1% of pilots are
bad apples.
Okay.
It's a phrase that we've heard used in a lot of these stories.
Sure. Now, all of a sudden, it's everybody's problem. And you get this with the FAA, I believe it is, right? The Federal Aviation Administration, I want to say. There's no such thing as 1%. There's no such thing as bad pilots, period. That is not a job where
you're not a pilot anymore. Once you've proven that you're a bad one, then okay.
That's it,
you
right?
You don't do this commercially anymore.
Right. Exactly. When it comes to like doctors and you can lose your medical license. You can be disbarred if you're a bad lawyer, all of these things. There's all this sort of oversight, but you know, for policing, we've given them carte blanche to write their own rules, to insulate themselves from the consequences of their actions.
Qualified immunity.
And oftentimes it's Black people, Black and Brown communities and poor communities that end up bearing the brunt of police violence. We end up incarcerated or getting involved in the carceral system in this country because of bad actors or because of a litany of other circumstances. And that shapes outcomes, not just for individuals, but for communities. Let's add one more thing. I know I'm on my soapbox here, but follow me. I'm going to add one more thing here. Oftentimes, the recruitment tactics for police are in such a way that they attract people who have a predisposition toward violence. If your police recruitment video shows everybody in a tank riding through a war zone, jumping out and shooting, you know, in the practice fields or whatever, hashtag Stop Cop City, folks jumping out, shooting guns.
It's too late. I think they already.
No, it's not. It's never too late.
They already moved forward.
No, it's never too late. I had a conversation with Yanajah Lone Wolf recently on the BIN Daily podcast. And there's still some movement there. So keep the faith, everyone.
Discouraging story.
Keep the faith, everyone. But, you know, if they're playing this like death metal music in the background and they have like the Punisher logo, you know, that you might be attracting a violent sort of person to engage in this. Add to that the systemic and historical composition of police, which is overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male. And it's not an accurate reflection of the population. And so you end up with this toxic mix of folks who are deciding what policing is. But because that's what we're used to, because this is what we've seen, then we find it hard to challenge that. So the 1% of police is too high a number. And I believe that that's even too, you seem like you might have had some data on that.
It's close to 10,000 officers would be 1%.
Okay.
So you're talking about 10,000 potential murderers, drug traffickers, kidnappers.
Again, in this
bad actors. Let's make it a little bit more general and a little bit more palatable. But that's 10,000, though. That's not a couple hundred. That's not a couple.
Yeah.
Right? Because one bad pilot would be too many.
Yeah.
10,000 possible bad actors should be way too many.
Right. And again, this is a thought experiment. I suspect that there are more than 1%. You can just look at the domestic violence that is reported for police officers. That's reported, right? It's common knowledge that police officers are prone to domestic violence. Again, These recruitment tactics tend to recruit people with a predisposition toward violence. They want to beat them up. They want to shoot them up. They want to, you know, do this sort of stuff. So I say all that to say, rethinking policing was the order of the day. Still is, very much so. And one of the things that came from that rethink was this idea of community policing, right? In other words, we don't need to invest billions of dollars into policing. We can invest into programs that actually have a direct and proven impact on crime rates. Things like daycare, access to daycare has a direct effect on crime rates. It is proven, it is well documented. Buying another tank, hiring more officers and giving them more badges and guns, better training. They've been better training since the 50s. These things do not work. They do not cause crime rates to go down. Daycares do. How about that? Right? So you start to begin understand how a rethink.
Access to daycare.
Access to daycare, sure.
Access to jobs.
Keep going.
Access to land, access to capital.
Fair housing.
Food, yep. Housing, medicine.
Yep. All the above.
All of those
healthcare.
Things.
Healthcare. Listen.
Increase the likelihood that your neighborhood is safer. Not 100 more cops patrolling your neighborhood.
How about this? For those listening, think of the safest neighborhood you know. The safest neighborhood you've ever been in. Just think of it. Imagine it. The platonic ideal. In your mind's eye, is there a police officer on every corner keeping it safe?
You might not picture a police squad car at all.
So what makes that neighborhood safe? The fact that nobody needs anything. What is the point of crime? Now, granted, there's going to be greedy people no matter what. That's part of the human race. We all have either had greedy moments, or sometimes there's people who are just greedy. They want more than their fair share. We have people who they're violent people. They're violent.
Just like there are officers that are bad faith actors or bad actors.
Yeah, that's a human condition.
Yeah, human beings in general. There are some of us who do not have good intentions for other human beings, sadly.
Sure, sure. But that neighborhood, critically, that neighborhood that you imagined wasn't safe because there's police everywhere. So the idea that increasing police presence and putting them in bad neighborhoods is going to somehow affect crime shows that you know full well, listening to us, you know full well that that is not an effective strategy. And you could start with, again, the programs that Q mentioned, with healthcare, with job opportunities, with access to daycare, with access to fair housing, you know, et cetera, on and on. And once you start asking, well, who's going to pay for these things? Well, I know a group that is actively harming this community that has way more money than they know what to do with, and you're thinking about it wrong. You're thinking about public safety wrong. We can take the money from these police, put it into programs to where we don't need the police, and then have people do jobs where they don't have to carry a murder weapon. I got to imagine that at some point, an officer has to come to terms with the fact that I'm carrying a weapon. Its only function is to end a life. This is not, I hope I never have to end a life. If I lived 100 years and never had to end a life, that'd be better.
So here's the problem. I think the normal
control officer, yeah, the normal control in this experience.
No, I mean the normal human thought would be that, right? It's the same with our military. We are kind of sensitized to the idea that we ship and fly over to other countries and murder people because in whatever the given circumstance, they're the bad guy. It's okay to murder the bad guy.
Yeah.
Our country has done a very good job of giving our police officers a bad guy.
Mm.
So they are not thinking, I hope I don't have to. No, there's a bad guy that I need to do this to protect and serve.
Well, how about this? So once they've become super duper indoctrinated and they're police first and not people first, right? Because we've had that conversation on the show. That may be true. But what I'm talking about is human beings who happen to have that occupation and have not, let's say, maybe they have not crossed over fully into like, I'm a cop even when I'm
at
the pool.
I don't even mean in extreme cases though, right? Like you said, the type of person that gravitates to that job, even with the purest intentions of serving and protecting, that idea has to be from somewhere, protecting us from someone.
Fair. So how about this? I have, and this is perhaps my mistake, I have a global view now of police, as do you, Q. I've been to, I couldn't even tell you how many countries around this planet of ours. And I have been to all of 50 of the states, U.S. states. So I've seen how that looks, you know, in the same tactics, and they're sitting on the highway clocking and all this sort of stuff, right? But elsewhere in the world, recruitment tactics are very different. You know, the gun part of the job is very, 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 very secondary. The primary part of the job is helping people, being a presence. And, you know, you're on the way to, you know, to the purse napping. If you realize that there's a person, a woman crossing the street and she needs help because she's in danger, you might stop and help the woman cross the street before you continue after the purse napper. You prioritize things versus over here. If the purse napper, we need to execute this purse napper. We need to take them down. And this is bringing safety and justice. You know, it's a different way of thinking about it, right?
I mean, you hear Americans talk about nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we talk about it, and even the way we frame it, it's false even in that sense, right? In those other countries, they see each other as countrymen and countrywomen.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So citizen first countries have this idea of actually protecting and serving each other.
Yeah.
We're all countrymen and women, no matter the color of your skin, right? They're countrymen and women first, and then whatever needs to be the specific description.
Mm-hmm.
Here is absolutely different. You're Black first. It's called African American. You're Black first.
Mm-hmm.
You're not countrymen first. You're not countrywoman first. And in a lot of cases, being Black means criminal, means bad, means enemy, means the person that I'm protecting everyone else from. So that's what I'm saying. Even the purest of us
has grown up in this environment
with skin that looks just like mine and yours.
They've grown up in this environment. Yeah.
Our country has made us the enemy before you even go through the recruiting, before you go to academy, before you learn what this job means.
I know what you mean.
You know what I mean? So yeah. In other countries where the idea is we want these outcomes to not result in death, similar to the way that other countries react to mass shootings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, too many of our fellow countrymen and women and or children died on this day. This will never happen again if we can help it.
Let's change it now.
Everything we can to change it.
Right now. Yeah. Well, because again, I have that global view. I've seen how police move in Hong Kong. I've seen how police move in New Zealand. I've seen how, you know, all different places around the world. One of the things that I come back to on the show quite frequently is that I believe it's New Zealand where they have guns, the officers have guns, but they keep it in the trunk of their car. And it's not like they had to keep it in the trunk of the car because, you know, they were out of pocket and that's a new strategy, a new compromise. They keep it in the trunk of the car the same way you keep a jack and a spare tire.
Or
like it's
fire
just,
extinguisher.
Yeah, just in case you need it. Yeah, isn't that? I'm not going to carry it with me. It's heavy. I'm not going to kill anybody. Kill somebody. You know what I mean? It's just crazy to think that way. But over here, again, because we fully bought in because of copaganda since Dragnet hit the TV shows in collaboration with the LAPD, and they were able to design the episodes, and the cops were always the good guys and the bad guys were always doing this, blah, blah, blah. And really tailor make a narrative for the viewing public that has us seeing police as the super duper ultimate heroes. And they're like almost these superhuman creatures that never make mistakes. I know that in the front of your mind, you can conceive of people making mistakes as officers. But the fact is that we've given them so much freedom that their mistakes, we don't even question it.
Too free.
Yeah, exactly.
But you teased a positive case study for this.
So community policing. This comes from the New York Times. What happened when a Brooklyn neighborhood policed itself? Okay. This is one of the ideas that comes from defunding the police, right? We can still have officers, but community policing is a way to rethink policing. So I'll read. And a side note, similar programs are underway in Oregon, in Denver, Rochester, New York, and other places, according to the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning think tank. And the group estimated that almost 40% of calls to police could be handled by community responders. Okay. All right. In Brownsville, the effort not only gives residents more say over what public safety looks like, but it can deter crime if people know there are more eyes watching. This comes from Brooklyn District Attorney Eric Gonzalez. It's quoted as saying, a lot of people worry that if police systems are not fully active, crime will go up, he said. But the Safety Alliance has been thriving amid a positive trend in the 73rd precinct, Gonzalez said. In the first half of this year, homicides fell 50%. Shootings fell 25%, and the rate of grand larcenies of automobiles also fell, even as it rose in other neighborhoods, he said. One set of watching eyes belongs to Almond, who's a 47-year-old former gang member who spent more than 13 years in prison for a bank robbery. Now, he's now the good guy, and he's helping provide safety in his own community. All right. He returned to Brownsville in 2014. His past, along with his calm, straightforward approach, helps him navigate conflicts. During one Safety Alliance week, he persuaded a man going into a bodega with a gun to give him the weapon and go home. The next day, that same man returned, but this time to volunteer. He spent all day squashing beefs and breaking up fights. So here's a case study in Brownsville, home of the brave. Shout out to MOP one time. I love
small sample size. However, you cannot argue with the results. 50% decrease in shootings, 25% or in murders, 25% decrease in shootings. That's significant.
So bear in mind that rethinking policing is something is a worthwhile endeavor. And then in freeing up the fiscal resources, you can invest in programs that actually do impact crime. It's just some food for thought. Right?
And now
Proper propaganda. Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists with journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines. Sidestepping the borders.
All right, for those of you just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
That smooth, silky voice that you hear. Yes, that is Ramses Ja. The regular person voice that you hear.
Stop it.
Is myself. Reverend Estella named McQuinton. Most of y'all know me as Q.
That's the man.
You are tuned in to Civic Cypher.
Sir, stick around. We got a lot more show in store for you. We are going to be talking about fatherhood.
Love it.
It's Father's Day weekend.
I love it sometimes. Don't let me lie to y'all. My daughter be having me on the edge sometimes. Yeah. I love it most of the time, though. Fatherhood go hard.
Yes, indeed. We're talking about Black fatherhood. Specifically, there's a lot of myths that you may have heard about Black fathers. And we are here to let you know the truth and dispel a lot of those myths. Also, we're going to spend some time talking about the largest mass U.S. deportation. We're sharing our Way Black History Fact with our Mexican-American brothers and sisters today. But first and foremost, we're discussing BABA, Becoming a Better Ally, Baba. Today's Baba is sponsored by Unknown Union, the fashion house situated at the intersection of meaning, innovation, and culture. More info, check unknownunion.com. All right. Today, pulled this from the Huffington Post. This is a really cool story. Florida college students rebuke Ron DeSantis by hosting their own graduation.
Talk to me nice.
All right. Students at New College of Florida, a small liberal arts school that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has sought to remake in his own image, say they'll host their own graduation ceremony on their own terms after the college invited Scott Atlas, a former Donald Trump advisor, to give the commencement speech at the official ceremony. DeSantis has stoked fury among new college students and national voters alike by leveraging a culture war on so-called wokeness against schools and corporations across the state. He has focused his campaign on New College of Florida, a public college in Sarasota that he's been rebuilding as a bastion of conservative leadership. Many students want nothing to do with the man who's expected to run against, or who's running against Trump for the GOP nomination, or with his vision for the school. There's a quote. The new administration that has spent the past 4 months attacking our students and community cannot in good faith celebrate our graduating students and their accomplishments. Unquote. The GoFundMe page for the new graduation ceremony reads, commencement is supposed to be a celebration of graduating students and the people who have shaped this school to be what it is. And just so you know, the students have raised more than $100,000, which goes toward the venue, food, security, and insurance and transportation to and from the campus, according to the students' GoFundMe page. And The fundraiser received a $15,000 donation from Save New College, a coalition of students and alumni who seek to protect the school from a hostile political takeover. So shout out to those students being forward thinking and writing their own story. I love
shout
that.
Shout out to the allies that donated supported, to that cause. Indeed. For sure.
That's a special one. All right. Fatherhood. First off, happy Father's Day to all the fathers.
One time.
Not sure.
Y'all be doing Father's Day bad though. Some of y'all don't even know it was Father's Day. Y'all like, it's Father's Day? Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that's fair. That's very fair.
Welcome to our lives. Mother's Day was popping.
Yeah, man.
I think I bought 5 dozen roses on Mother's
Day. That sounds right.
I think I might get a gift certificate to the Home Depot. I don't know.
That's all right, though. Listen, man.
Babies love me, though. So that matters.
That's it, man. So, real quick, I want to say something. We were watching a comedian, and I forget his name, but he's a very funny comedian. He gave us some statistics on Father's Day. He said the most celebrated holiday in the world is Christmas. Checks out. Second most celebrated holiday in the world is Mother's Day. Checks out. You know? And then he said the 20th most celebrated holiday is Father's Day.
His name is Al Sadiq.
Al Sadiq, yeah. So the 20th most celebrated holiday is Father's Day. And, you know, we're not sure when you're listening to us, just because so many stations, you know, air our show at different times. But we hope you're listening on Father's Day or prior to Father's Day, because it's a little bit different. He made a point of saying, I can't name 18 other holidays.
So I can't name 18 holidays total.
Period.
And Father's Day is ranked
in number 20.
Ranked 20th. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Where's Mother's Day ranked?
Second.
And what's number one?
Christmas.
Of course. Jesus, Mama.
And way down there.
We'll get back to you, Dad.
So, and then he said something that was really funny. He said, Arbor Day is 13th.
Shout out to Ann Arbor, Michigan, man.
He said, I don't even know.
Time for the trees.
He's like, I don't know what Arbor Day is. But yeah, it's a holiday about trees. It's 13th. And Father's Day is 20th. So it's not even
we ranked.
It's not even right
after
behind the trees.
Arbor Day, man.
Yeah, man. But being a father is a beautiful experience. And that's what we want to talk
sometimes
to you about.
Sometimes thankless.
Today. Yes. Very
but beautiful.
Very often. But for Black people in this country, we have been dealing with a falsehood that is very dangerous. Now, I want to make sure that I say this. Fatherlessness is a thing in Black households and in white households and in Hispanic. And
every
single one. Across the board.
Across the board.
It is a thing. There are households that where there is not a Black father. There are households where there's not a Black mother. There are households where there's not a white father. A lot of them, and a lot of households where there's not a white mother. These are universal things that do happen, but for some reason, there's this myth that Black people are disproportionately unavailable to our children.
I love my brother. You guys don't even understand. His grace has no bounds. He said, for some reason, this myth exists. Like that reason is some sort of mystery. But he's such a professional. He's so good at this thing that we do. Telling stories the way that we tell them that's compelling to you as an audience, that gives you something to look forward to maybe 3 minutes from now. He's so much better at that than me. I'd be so mad on this radio, y'all. You have no idea. I'm trying to smile and laugh through it, but I'd be so mad.
Well,
for some reason.
There's good news here. There's good news here. Okay. Let me start us off with some information. Okay. I pulled this one from fatherhood.gov. Now, first off, I implore you, as our listener, please go and Google this. We say Google a lot of stuff. If we say Google it, Google it. So that way you don't feel like it's our biased opinion, right?
And but Google this is free too. There's no fee.
You don't even got to pay for that.
Yeah. And if you do, you know, send us a little message, shoot us a DM. We'll get you together.
Yep. We'll take care of you. But I want to make sure that this one, you actually Google it so you can see and you can read the articles and you can see the data. Okay. But I'm going to share a little bit. First off, a very, very compelling study. I think it took place in 2013 and was published in 2014, somewhere around there, from the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, which is a United States government agency. And they track the health of.
And note that the .gov and fatherhood.gov, that you can't just
get
that.
Yeah, you have to be a government agency.
Because you want to.
Right. That, so these are official sources that we're citing, but I implore you to look this up yourself. Okay. Fatherhood.gov. Statistics show that close to 70% of all births to Black mothers are non-marital. Okay. Giving rise to the stereotype that Black fathers are largely absent. Okay. So for folks that maybe didn't follow that, 70% of all births to Black mothers non-marital means 70% of the births to Black women, the women are not married at the time that the birth takes place. Okay. And that is what helped give rise to the stereotype that Black fathers are largely absent. Now, Q made a point. He said that I said for some reason, I know the exact reason. I know when it started. I know that it was the Democrats behind it. I know all this stuff because obviously I've had to do the research. But, and we've talked about this on the show before, but these myths have grown out of these. So how about this? People extrapolate different conclusions. They draw different conclusions based on this data. And those conclusions that they draw are not indeed based in the real data, but there is a loose connection, like we've illustrated here. Unwed mothers means that there's no fathers in the home, right? But what I'm going to show you now is that that's not true. So I'll keep reading. However, while Black fathers are less likely than white and Hispanic fathers to marry their child's mother, many Black fathers continue to parent through cohabitation and visitation, providing caretaking, financial, and in-kind support. Okay. Now, I don't have this in front of me because I didn't plan on making this tangent, but I want to make sure that I give you some history here. So don't hold me to this, but I'm going to start you on your path if you, our listener, wants to indeed research this further. The way that I remember it off the top of my head, in the, might have been coming out of the 50s into the 60s, there was a study that had taken place to determine the lack of wealth in Black households. Again, I'm just kind of doing this from memory. And rather than looking at the facts, rather than looking at how the, let's go all the way back, the legacy of Jim Crow, the legacy of Black codes,
and the transcontinental.
Sure. But just in this country, in this country, post slavery, when people could have jobs, the legacy of, you know, okay, you cannot have a job unless you're working for a white man and they can pay you what they want. You cannot sue and blah, blah, blah. It's hard to build wealth. And then, of course, in Jim Crow South, you know, if you have a Black community where you have a doctor and you have a teacher in a schoolhouse and blah, 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 and these communities are attacked when they get too big, you know, it's hard to build enough wealth and then pass it on. These properties were claimed by white people and, you know, rebuilt in their names and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, it's hard to get that wealth started. But then we fast forward. Let's go to, the Great Depression. And how the welfare programs were not designed to accommodate Black people. Let's go to, of course, redlining. We talk about that a lot, and how real estate was something that propped up the wealth of white people, and Black people were not able to enjoy that. We can talk about the GI Bill and how that was given to white people and largely withheld from Black people who served this country as a means of getting wealth and starting lives and building. And there's a ton of other things. Some of them are actually documented with the racist terminology from the day. But these are government programs. There's a whole list of them, right? So rather than looking at all of these things and then saying, well, that's clearly the reason why there's disproportionate wealth there, they tried to put the blame on Black people. Again, this was a Democratic-backed study. So the Democrats did this. I know that. I'll see that entirely to my Republican or conservative brothers and sisters. I know where it comes from. Rather than this country taking
also smart, realizing though that party at the time,
they well, you're right. They switched more after the 60s. That's fair.
That
fair point.
Party at the time fair kind point. Of held the position that the Republican Party holds today.
Fair so point.
It's not apples to apples.
Fair point. Rather than this country taking responsibility for those things up to that point. Remember, we haven't even gotten to the modern era where we're talking about the war on drugs and, you know, the prison industrial complex and school to prison pipeline. And we're not talking about, you know,
things existed back then too.
Yeah, but we're not talking about that yet, you know, because we had to see those in a modern light. We're just talking about what happened back then. Okay. So rather than this country saying, you know what, we have stood in the way and we've allowed our citizens to stand in the way of Black people gaining the same level of wealth, or at least a decent level of wealth, so that they can be self-determined, more self-determined than they are. Rather than accepting the responsibility, this country rather put together this study and drew these bogus conclusions. And part of those conclusions were to say that the Black fathers were not in the home. Now, the reason for that is because Black men back then didn't marry their spouse legally because a single woman qualified for more assistance. Remember, we're talking about the legacy of the Great Depression. We're talking about these are very, very poor people that have a hard go at it. So whatever opportunities they can get, they'll get it. Now, that's not to say 100% of Black women marked that they were unmarried. You know what I mean? But the disproportionate data was the result of that condition. It was a survival tactic.
And also a kind of grasp from thin air conclusion that unmarried meant absent.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mary must not be there.
That's what the next part of the reading suggests. I'm glad you're on it. I'm glad you're on it.
On top of that,
I'm glad you're on it because, again, I grew up in a world where Black fathers were present. There were some Black fathers that were not present, but critically, there were some white fathers that were not present. There were some Hispanic fathers that were not present. There were some Asian fathers that were not present. They either died, went to jail, just deflected, flaked, started a new family, whatever. These things happen.
Or broke up with the mom. Because sometimes relationships don't be working out.
Say that then.
Sometimes people be tripping. It is not more complicated than that in a lot of these cases. Sometimes mama and or daddy tripping. So the other one was like, okay, me and the kids going to go over here. You can still be dad, but you and I just ain't vibing.
So I'm going to get to that too. Now, the thing is, which group has unfairly had this label assigned to them that they're deadbeat dads? Oh, that would be Black people, right? Now, my lived experience doesn't support that, nor does the data. I'll continue.
I was going to say, according to the data, no one's does.
Yeah. So now I'm going to read a bit from Newsweek. People conflate marriage statistics with fatherlessness. When it comes to Black dads specifically, most, in fact, live with their children. A CDC study found that about 2.5 million Black fathers were living with their children and about 1.7 were officially living apart from them. Okay. So the majority, vast majority, live in the house with their children, right? So this myth, this pervasive myth that's never been backed by any data other than
it didn't have to be.
Who qualifies for welfare. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, it didn't have to be, right? When you list statistics, you know, kind of blind statistics to an audience, this being the entire country,
they're inclined to believe it.
They're not only inclined to believe it, but they want to. Like I said, this country has always positioned the Black man as the enemy. So of course they're not there for their children.
Yeah.
Of course they're deadbeats. Of course they're absent. Mm-hmm. It's just the nature of Black men. So you condition people to readily accept information like that without doing any additional follow-up research to mm-hmm. prove you wrong. They don't want you to be wrong. Mm-hmm. They want to lean into that idea being true, so they readily receive that type of confirmation biased information.
I want to take a moment here because you bring me the thought. This conversation about reparations is not necessarily a conversation about reparations for slavery. I said something a moment ago. I said that this country has a responsibility to her Black citizens. That is not to say this country needs to hand out free stuff to Black people. That is to say that this country has actively harmed and stood in the way of the progress of Black people. And now, often enough, it's our more conservative brothers and sisters on the right that throw their hands up and say, hey, look, man, that was a long time ago. We were all born in the early 80s and the late 70s or the whatever. We all had a similar go at it. That don't bring that stuff up. But they don't look at the legacy of it. They don't look at how those false narratives, those falsehoods have influenced public opinion, and white people's public opinion in particular, but Black people's public Black opinion people too. Yeah, I absolutely.
Man, I grew up hearing the fatherless.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And my father wasn't there.
So for you, it was like a real.
So then I knew before I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up, what career choice I wanted, that I wanted to be a dad.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to make sure that what I was feeling was not felt by someone else. So right. I wanted to be a dad so that I could be that present, loving thing that I craved and missed as a child.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So, and people around me who had a similar experience very much believed the idea that Black fathers were absent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though I had multiple neighbors whose dads I essentially grew up with yeah. because they were very present. You know, you take that one example and you blow it up and then you put it in a direction.
It's confirmation bias.
That are going to, yeah, that their biases will be confirmed by this data that you're providing, whether it's accurate or not. You only need an example
yeah.
to point to.
Yep. So I understand that. And I kind of went through a similar thing because when I was younger, my mother and my father, they split up. And my mother moved to Arizona. My father stayed in California, right? So growing up, then you start hearing that, you know, Black men are horrible fathers and they leave their kids and this and that.
Shout out to my mom for never perpetuating that stereotype.
Same.
And never saying anything bad about my father. Never like beating him down to lift herself up. She let me love him. She let me miss him. She let me admire him. She even let him break my heart, right? She let me get my hopes up. Because she wanted me to believe in fatherhood. She wanted me to love my dad, even if he wasn't perfect. And even if things weren't great between them, she still wanted to allow him to be the hero that I wanted him to be. So shout out to my mom for just being incredible in general, but specifically in that case for letting me develop positive thoughts and a joy for the idea of becoming a dad one day. I didn't resent my father because he was gone. I just wanted to make sure that when I had the opportunity to become a dad, that I was incredible at it. And I don't know if I'm living up to that, but I am trying as hard as I possibly can to.
I think that I think that's probably more commonplace than you might know for people where their dad is not present. That experience might be a little bit more commonplace, you know, because I think that we all recognize how fatherhood impacts children. This is another thing that I know, again, I'm doing this from memory, but please look it up. Outcomes for children that grow up in a single parent household where the mother is the single parent are way worse overall than outcomes for children that grow up in a two parent household with a mother and a father. I think everybody can agree with that, right? Having a mother and a father in the home shapes the outcomes for the children way better than just a single mother. Okay, with me? All right. Having a single father household, the outcomes for the children is identical to a dual parent household.
Wow.
So having a father, at least in terms of the outcomes that we value in this country, like career success and school and all that sort of stuff, fathers are way, way more important based on the metrics that we're measuring. I'm not talking about love and you know, that sort of stuff. Those are quality of life. Yeah, those things we can't measure. So I don't want to take anything away from moms.
To us.
But it's Dad's Day and we need to celebrate. So dads help shape the outcomes for their children a lot more. So I think that mothers know that. So I think your experience is something that a lot of people who have had access to that experience would agree with. Now I want to read this. Again, this is from, what was it, Newsweek? Yeah, Newsweek. Okay. Counting by the number of children rather than the number of fathers presents a different picture. The Census Bureau reports that slightly more than half of Black children live in homes headed by one parent. Again, the legacy of, you know, the taking advantage of the systems that are available to you and providing the best way you can. which is usually but not always the mother. This is explained in part by the non-co-residential fathers having more children. It is also true that Black children are more likely than others to be born out of wedlock. But neither of these things makes children fatherless. That's what you said, Q. All right. Millions of kids live with their fathers half the time, or at least part of the time, through joint custody arrangements. But children generally have one legal address, which is particularly important for purposes of determining school districts. Most often, the legal address is the mother's. This is a major reason that fatherlessness statistics in general are overblown. Fathers' homes all too often are not counted officially as being homes with children. Mine is, though. Also, some unmarried couples live together, making the marriage statistics even more misleading. And then I want to read this and we'll be done. Meanwhile, among fathers who live with their children, Black dads are in many ways the most involved in their kids' lives. Black fathers, 70%, were most likely to have bathed, dressed, diapered, or helped their children use the toilet every day compared with white and Hispanic fathers, 60% and 45%, compared to Black fathers, which is 70%. That's from the CDC. Also, more Black fathers than white fathers took their children to and from activities every day and helped their kids with homework every day. The lead researcher told that the study marked, quote, the debunking of the Black fathers being absent myth, unquote. All right, we have to move on, but please continue your research.
And happy Father's Day again.
All right, it's time for the Way Black History Fact. Today's Way Black History Fact is sponsored by Underground Beach Club. From the streets to the beach, for the finest in beachwear, visit undergroundbeachclub.com. Today we're talking about the largest mass U.S. deportation in history. This comes from history.org. July is scorching in Mexicali. The Mexican city just across the border from Calexico, California, averages 108 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer, but temperatures often swell into the 120s. In 1955, thousands of disoriented people roamed the city streets as the sun bore down on them. They had just been dumped there by American immigration officials, snatched from their lives and jobs in the United States and thrown into a city where they didn't know anyone. These Mexican immigrants had been caught in the snare of Operation WB. I want to pause here for a second. Operation WB. The WB is, we've abbreviated it on this show because we want to be as sensitive as we can. This is a racist term. Most folks would agree that it's a racist term nowadays, but this is an official U.S. government operation. It was named Operation WB. If you want, you can Google it yourself, but it is, I've abbreviated it so that we can read this story, but it's not actually called that. It's a slur for immigrants from Mexico. This moment is meant to show love and to shine light on the history of our Mexican American brothers and sisters. Q and I have familial connections to Mexican people, and we love our brothers and sisters. We just want to take a moment to make sure that we're doing this as best we can, being as empathetic as we can be. I'll keep reading. The biggest mass deportation of undocumented workers in the United States history. As many as 1.3 million people may have been swept up in the Eisenhower era campaign with a racist name, which was designed to root out undocumented Mexicans from American society. The short-lived operation used military-style tactics to remove Mexican immigrants, some of them American citizens, from the United States. Though millions of Mexicans had legally entered the country through joint immigration programs with the first half of the 20th century, Operation WB was designed to send them back to Mexico. With the help of the Mexican government, which sought the return of Mexican nationals to alleviate a labor shortage, Border Patrol agents and local officials used military techniques and engaged in coordinated tactical operation to remove the immigrants. Along the way, they used widespread racial stereotypes to justify their sometimes brutal treatment of immigrants. Inside the United States, anti-Mexican sentiment was pervasive and harsh portrayals of Mexican immigrants as dirty, disease-bearing, and irresponsible were the norm. Sound familiar, Q? Sound like somebody in the past few years that was maybe president?
Unfortunately, all too familiar and all too recent.
All right. During Operation WB, tens of thousands of immigrants were shoved into buses, boats, and planes and sent to often unfamiliar parts of Mexico, where they struggled to rebuild their lives. In Chicago, three planes a week were filled with immigrants and flown to Mexico. In Texas, 25% of all the immigrants deported were crammed into boats later compared to slave ships, while others died of sunstroke, disease, and other causes while in custody. It is not clear how many American citizens were swept up in Operation WB, but the United States later claimed that 1.3 million people total were deported. However, some historians dispute that claim. Though hundreds of thousands of people were ensnared, says historian Kelly Little Hernandez, the number of deportees was drastically lower than the United States reported, likely closer to 300,000, due to immigrants who were caught, deported, and captured again after re-immigrating. It was possible to estimate the total number of people deported under the program. Mass deportations of Mexican immigrants from the U.S. to date to the Great Depression, when the federal government began a wave of deportations, rather than include Mexican-born workers in the New Deal welfare programs. According to historian Francisco Valderrama, the U.S. deported over 1 million Mexican nationals, 60% of whom were U.S. citizens of Mexican descent. During the 1930s, Valderrama told Fresh Air's Terry Gross that the program was referred to as repatriation to give it a sense of being voluntary. In reality, though, it was anything but. Despite a widespread belief among native-born Americans that Mexicans came to the United States to steal jobs from American workers, many were invited to the country to work in its fields. In 1942, the U.S.-Mexican Farm Labor Program, also known as Operation Bracero, after the Spanish term for manual laborer, began. The program funneled Mexicans into the United States on a legal temporary basis in exchange for guaranteed wages and humane treatment, an attempt by the Mexican government to stave off the discrimination faced by earlier immigrants. However, not all employers wanted to follow the guidelines or pay the 30-cent an hour guaranteed wage, which would be about $4.51 in modern dollars. Nor did the Mexican government want Mexicans to work in Texas, which continued its discrimination against Mexican people, and the state was excluded from the program between 1942 and 1947. That's where WBs came in. The racial epithet was used to describe Mexicans who illegally entered Texas by crossing the Rio Grande River. The government turned a blind eye to Texans' employment of these undocumented immigrants, even after hiring undocumented workers was declared illegal. The fact is, they needed these workers to work the fields.
Not past tense.
Still, yes, absolutely.
Still need.
All right. An estimated 4.6 million Mexicans entered the country legally through the Bracero program between 42 and 64, and states like California soon became dependent on Bracero workers. At the same time, hundreds of thousands of Mexican workers crossed the border without permission and found jobs on the farms of employers willing to flout the law. In 1953, the government decided it had enough. By refusing to participate in the Bracero program, South Texas farmers essentially received their labor for less money than farmers who complied. And Border Patrol head Harlan B. Carter, a convicted murderer who killed a Latino as a teenager in 1931 and later headed the National Rifle Association, was frustrated by the sheer number of Mexican immigrants, both legal and undocumented, in the United States. He convinced President Eisenhower to ramp up immigration and enforcement efforts. In 1953, Carter tried to get the National Guard involved in a forerunner of Operation of WB. But since the U.S. military is not supposed to be used to enforce domestic laws, he couldn't gain authorization to do so. Instead, in 1954, the government introduced Operation WB, which used Border Patrol resources instead. Operation WB may not have had troops, but it used military tactics and propaganda to achieve its goals. It was headed in part by General Joseph Swing, head of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and was planned like a war strike. Okay. Sorry, that's a lot to read. I was reading fast because I wanted to get it all in, but I still didn't finish. Please go to history.gov and read about this. Then you'll start to understand the basis of anti-Mexican sentiment in this country and why it's very, very dangerous and harmful to our Mexican brothers and sisters, Mexican-American brothers and sisters, and Mexican brothers and sisters. Anyway, that's going to do it for us here on Civic Cypher. So I'd like to thank you all for tuning in. Once again, I'm your host, Ramses Jha.
I am once again at the end of the show, disappointed, heartbroken, upset. We got some disgusting truths in the history of this country.
Yeah.
And some of them we have yet to ever reconcile with or apologize for.
But we're coming to terms with them. And we appreciate you listening. We appreciate you supporting. Please continue to do so. CivicCypher.com. Before we go, I want to say thank you to Kimberly Gamble, comma PSY dot D dot because she wrote us a really nice letter and told us to keep going. And if you want to do the same, again, hit civiccypher.com, follow us, support us, subscribe, share, and all of the above. And until next week, y'all, peace. Hey, yo, we handle it. These brothers are fabulous. Dilated, showing you where rhyme travel is. Worlds are spit tunes from sunlight to moon. Bussing off stage like gunfight saloons. Pull my mic back, you like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander slash beat expander, here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show, get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist. Headlines, wake up, refuse and resist. Like this, like this, like this, like this.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture.
Thanks for tuning in.
Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.
Tune in to KBOO every other Tuesday at 3 a.m. for the Vinyl Pajama Party with your erstwhile host, Brian.
And eventually,
you never know what you will find on your radio slash interwebs.